overview of Canto 1 and Canto 2. Any particular points that anyone has? Very good. The Harinam Anukirtanam team is one of the most important parts of the second canto of tradition. Any other points?
The second canto of matter is described, how the creation is completely described. The purpose of that is to become detached from that.
Very good. Yeah, creation is described in very brief detail in chapters 5 and 6 of the second canto as a precursor to the elaboration which will be given in the third canto on the creation. The creation, the saga and the visaga, the preliminary creation by Mahavishnu and the secondary creation by the Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. These are discussed in great detail in the third canto three times. They'll be discussed again and again and again. The reason being because by deeply analysing through the process of Sankhya, Sankhya means analysis, by deeply analysing the material creation and understanding its temporary nature, then the soul who is entrapped within the material energy can become detached from the material world and can develop proper devotional attachment to Krishna. You can only become fully attached to Krishna when you first become detached from the material energy. And in order to become detached from the material energy, then you have to understand its temporary nature. So by studying the creation very carefully within the third canto, one can then develop the necessary vairagya or detachment so that one can then proceed to the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam, which is the Ashraya, or the Sun and Bone of the Bhagavatam. One can approach Krishna's pastimes and become attached to Krishna, free from material affinity. And then one's attachment is complete or perfect. Okay. So this is the reason why the Bhagavatam will discuss like this. Any other points? This is the Parivasa Sutra, or the governing verse of the entire Srimad Bhagavatam. Krishna is to Bhagavan Swayam. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And by understanding this verse, then one can, one understands that the entire Srimad Bhagavatam is an elaboration upon this one verse.
Well, one question to ask you. That is, when we are relating to the material energy, what should our mood be? Sometimes, like, we know that material energy is troubling us.
The mood is given within the second verse of the chapter of Shloki, Bhagavatam. Mm. Chapter, Canto 2, Chapter 9, Text 34. Mm. It's described that if you see anything separate from Krishna, then that is illusion. So therefore, the principle of how to understand how to relate with the material energy for a devotee is the principle taught by Rupa Goswami, which is Yukta Vairagya. Nirbandha Krishna Sambandhe Yukta Vairagya Uchite. If something cannot be connected to Krishna, then we renounce it. If something can be connected to Krishna, Krishna Sambandha means it can have a connection with Krishna, then we use it in Krishna's service, Yukta Vairagya. With a spirit of detachment, and not being attached to the thing for ourselves, but rather only using the thing for Krishna's pleasure. So that is the correct word.
So this energy actually sometimes, isn't it not separating the jivas away from Krishna? For some people, like when the illusory energy attracts, they forget Krishna and they go off in the illusory energy for millions of births. So isn't this energy separating the jivas from Krishna? Isn't that true?
Yeah, that's the duty of this energy.
So should it separate the jivas from Krishna and trouble them, or is it making them move towards Krishna? What is it actually doing?
It does both, has both functions like that. It's according to the desire of the living entity. If the living entity wants to be separate from Krishna, then the duty of Durga Devi, because Durga Devi is the personification of the material energy, Lord Shiva's wife, then she keeps everyone separate from Krishna. But if they desire to come back to Krishna, then she will assist them in coming back to Krishna. Any other points?
Yeah, We discussed how Lord Brahma was an illusion when he was born on the lotus flower, and how he hears from within his heart Lord Krishna's instructions to Tapodivya, and then he meditates on that instruction and he does tapasya for thousands of years. And there are some very powerful purports Prabhupada gives within that, like how an easygoing life and Krishna consciousness go in together, and how we have to do austerities if we want to advance in spiritual.
Very good. So this all took place in the Padmakalpa, the first, the beginning of the creation, like that, while Brahma appeared. So this will be described in great detail in the third canto, what actually took place, like that. It was only in the ninth chapter of the second canto, it only gave a preliminary description of what took place. Any other points?
Abhidaya Samana Prayojana.
Yeah, in the chapter of Shloki, those four seat verses of the Bhagavatam, verses 33 to 36 of the ninth chapter of the second canto, then it is described, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, the entire Vedic literatures and the Srimad Bhagavatam is the essence of the Vedic literatures, divided into those three subject matters: Krishna Sambandha, Bhakti Abhideya, and Prema Prayojana. So the chapter of Shloka is also divided into these three categories, and the entire stream of Bhagavatam and all of that is divided into those three categories. Any other points?
When Parikshit Maharaj was cursed by Brahmana, so Parikshit Maharaj put this snake around the Brahmana's neck. Prabhupada describes in the purport that normally Parikshit Maharaj won't do something like this to Brahmana, but he was forced to do that because of some yoga potency and because some greater purpose has to be fulfilled.
The purpose was that the reason, there's several reasons why that pastime took place, but the principal reason was so the Srimad Bhagavatam would be spoken. So therefore, Parikshit Maharaj became bewildered by the illusory energy of the Lord himself, the yoga mind potency, so that he would offend the Rishi, and then the unqualified son of the Rishi, Sringi, then he cursed Parikshit Maharaj, and that allowed the Srimad Bhagavatam to be spoken. Because he only had 7 days when Shukadev Goswami appeared at that time. That's what took place. Any other points?
Well, in this context, is it one of the reasons that Parikshit Maharaj's crown was golden and he was still wearing it, and because of the fact that Kali designs in gold? Is that one of the reasons, or it's just...
Yeah, it is said that in the earlier chapters like 16 and 17, when he punishes Kali, it's described in the Brahma Vaivata Purana that Kali said, please give me some resonance. And he said, then you can reside where the gold is being hoarded. So then, when Parikshit Maharaj left, it is described in the Brahma Vaivata Purana that he, in his golden crown, Kali entered into the golden crown, and he became confused and bewildered. And then it's described in that way, then when he entered the ashram of the sage, then because he was bewildered by Kali's potency, then he committed that offence to the sage. That's described. Any other thoughts?
Sorry, one cross question. Last week you said that when Parikshit Maharaj entered the ashram, it was within the yoga maya.
It was what?
When it was yoga maya potency was affected?
Yeah.
How did we say that now is the Kali was in the crown?
Yeah, so it means that was the Lord's arrangement. Yoga maya means the Lord's arrangement. When the Lord arranges something, that is called yoga maya. Like that. So the Lord arranged and allowed that pastime to take place. So if it's described that Kali entered into the crown, then that was the Lord's arrangement that took place. Like that. So it's the same. Okay. Same thing. Same thing. Anything else?
It says that your heart should melt when you chant holy name of Krishna.
Very good. Yeah, this is the goal of the process of chanting Hare Krishna, which the Bhagavatam is emphasizing. That when one chants, there should be tears within the eyes. Third chapter, 24th verse of this second canto describes this process. That when one chants, tears must come to the eyes. That is the perfection of chanting. That much feeling one has for Krishna. Okay, so now we'll begin Canto 3. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Narayanam Namaskritya.
Narayanam Namaskritya.
So, at the end of the second canto of the Bhagavatam, Shomika Rishi questions Suta Goswami, and he asked him, please describe what took place with the great Mahatma Vidura. Because back in the first canto, in the 13th chapter, it was described that Vidura returned back to Hastinapur after a long absence of around 30 years, and he chastised very heavily Dhritarashtra. And the 13th chapter of the first canto of the Bhagavatam is called Dhritarashtra Quit Sorrow. So he chastised Dhritarashtra, and he, how do you say?
Cut off the attachment.
Cut off the attachment. Yes. He inspired the spirit of renunciation within the heart of Dhritarashtra. So much so that Dhritarashtra, in the middle of the night, even though he was blind, he got up and he left the palace and just walked into the forest, followed by his wife Gandhari. Right? So much renunciation was inspired within his heart by Vidura, by his strong preaching. So then, that was mentioned back in the 13th chapter of the first canto. And now after finishing the first canto and the second canto being completed, the last three verses of the second canto, then Shomika Rishi asked Suta Goswami about Vidura once again. Because the topic of what took place in Vidura's 30-year absence from Hastinapur, nothing was described about that at this point in time. But obviously Vidura is a very significant personality, a very great personality. He's a Mahatma. And we'll see in the next few chapters, it will be described his actual position. He's Yamaraj himself. Yamaraj is one of the 12 Mahajanas, which are mentioned in Canto 6 of the Bhagavatam by Yamaraj himself. He lists 12 Mahajanas. So, he's one of them, and he takes birth due to the curse of Mandavya Muni. He takes birth as Vidura within the pastimes of Krishna. So he's an extremely exalted personality. So at the end of the second canto, three questions are asked. And these three questions, which are asked by Shonaka Rishi, will inspire Suta Goswami to speak what he heard from Shukadeva Goswami, because the same questions were asked by Parikshit Maharaj. Because Parikshit Maharaj and Shonaka Rishi are both very elevated personalities, so they've asked the same question like that. And Shukadeva Goswami, Suta Goswami will speak what Shukadeva Goswami spoke to Maharaj Parikshit. So, what is asked at this point, at the end of the second canto, by Shonaka Rishi and Parikshit Maharaj will form the basis of Canto 3 and Canto 4. That the next two cantos will be a conversation between Vidura and Maitreya. So, in the initial part of Canto 3, in the first few chapters, will describe how Vidura and Maitreya came to meet. That the history of why they met is extremely interesting. And then, around about the 8th chapter, I believe it is, around about there, then Maitreya will begin to answer Vidura's questions. And they will have a long conversation, and this conversation will carry through all the way through Canto 3 and Canto 4 on the Bhagavad Gita. Now, what this conversation is extremely interesting. But I won't tell you what it is. I will tell you, but I won't tell you tonight. Although I'm burning to tell you. But I don't think I'll tell you tonight. Unless somehow it manifests. It's very hard to say.
Sorry, what's the difference between Dharmaraj and Yamraj? Dharmaraj and Yamraj.
Same person. Dharma Raj means the king of Dharma, lord of Dharma. And Yamaraj means lord of death. Okay, same person. Because he is the one who deals out everyone's rewards and punishments for their good and bad karma at the end of their life. So he knows Dharma perfectly. So he's Dharma Raj, he's also Yamaraj. So
is this verse, the
son of Yamaraj. King Yudhishthira is the son of Yamaraj. So he got the same name as his father, Dharma Raj. Pandu Maharaj decided the first son would come from Yama, because he is Dharma Raj. So the king must know Dharma perfectly. So first he asked Kunti to call Yamaraj, and the first son born was Yudhishthira, who perfectly knew Dharma. Then he called, he needed a powerful son, so then he called Vayu, and Bhima was born. And then he thought, what's called Indra. So Indra came, and then Arjuna was born, who was the supreme archer, the most powerful warrior. And then Madri called the Ashwini Kumaras, and Nakul and Sahadev were born. So, the three questions which are asked by Shomika are, question number one, what were the topics discussed between Vidura and Maitreya? What was discussed? Okay, so this will be described in Canto 3 and 4, what was discussed. Second question, why did Vidura give up any connection with his family and why did he return home? So why did he give up connection with his family? Why? This will be answered actually in the first part of this chapter tonight. And why did he return home? We know from the 13th chapter that he returned home to preach to Dhritarashtra, to liberate Dhritarashtra. And a third question, what were Vidura's activities whilst in the places of pilgrimage? What did he do for those 30 years? Where did he go to? Who did he meet? What sort of activities took place? Okay. So this will formulate the basis for Canto 3 and Canto 4. Okay. So we'll begin reading Canto 3. And we'll read from verses 1 to 16 tonight. Give some brief history into background. Shukadeva Goswami said, after announcing his prosperous home and entering the forest, King Vidura, the great devotee asked this question of his grace, Maitreya Rishi. What else is there? Someone had a question? What else is there to say about the residential house of the Pandavas? Sri Krishna, the Lord of everything, acted as your minister. He used to enter that house as if it were his own, and he did not take any care of Duryodhana's house.
According to the Gaudiya Atita Veda Veda Tattva philosophy, anything which satisfies the sense of the Supreme Lord Sri Krishna is also Sri Krishna. For example, Sri Vrindavan Dham is non-different from Sri Krishna. Tat Dhamma Vrindavana, because at Vrindavana, the Lord enjoys the transcendental bliss of his internal potency. Similarly, the house of the Pandavas is also the source of transcendental bliss for the Lord. It is mentioned here that the Lord identified the house with his own self. Thus, the house of the Pandavas was as good as Vrindavana, and Vidura should not have given up that place of transcendental bliss. Therefore, the reason for his quitting the house was not exactly family misunderstanding. Rather, Vidura took the opportunity to meet Rishi Maitreya and discuss transcendental knowledge. For a saintly person like Vidura, any disturbance due to worldly affairs is insignificant. Such disturbances, however, are sometimes favorable for higher realization. and therefore the Yuga took advantage of a family misunderstanding in order to meet Maitreya Rishi.
Yeah. So what are the points here?
I can ask a question. It's not clear to me what it means. Who is speaking to whom? It says, Shri Krishna, the Lord of everything, acted as your minister.
So this is Shukadev speaking to Parikshit.
So Krishna acted as his minister?
Means minister of his family.
Okay.
Means minister of Arjuna and his grandfather.
The material disturbances in the life of the pure devotees is for a higher purpose. Because it is always arranged by the Lord.
And Vidura used that opportunity. He did not sit and brood, thinking that, you know, Duryodhana has insulted me or something like that, but he transformed that opportunity to for his own spiritual advancement. And therefore he left home to
for
and all that, so he left to do that. It seems that the second question is answered. He said that he left the home for to exchange transcendental knowledge with Maitreya Rishi.
Yeah. Yeah, this is the beginning of this answer.
It's always the pure devotees, they see everything as the Lord's arrangement. They don't think anything is separate from Krishna. Anything that happens in their life is all they see Krishna in that thing, and they relate like that, and then...
Yeah, that's
it. I was hearing Bhujan Prabhu's commentary on 1 to 16.
Yeah.
And Bhujan Prabhu says that Vidura was only able to see the higher hand of Krishna in this because he was detached. So unless we are detached from matter, we cannot see the hand of Krishna in our, you know, adverse situation.
Yes, one point. So this is the theme of this early part of this chapter, and it's one of the major themes of devotional life of the Srimad Bhagavatam. That one needs to develop this sense of detachment, this sense of renunciation from this world. A devotee does not become disturbed by apparently good or bad events which take place. When one is very fixed in devotional service, regardless of what takes place externally, the devotee will see this is the Lord's arrangement. He will not see that this is something separate from Krishna. Right? He will see that this suffering is for my own benefit. Or this favorable situation has also been sent by Krishna. So the devotee will see this. If something favorable is sent, he will say, well, Krishna is sending this in order for me to take this opportunity for his service, to increase his service. If Krishna is sending more facility, this facility is being sent so that I can use this facility in Krishna's service, to expand his service for his pleasure. And if something adverse is taking place, then the devotee sees that also as Krishna's arrangement. Krishna is obviously trying to detach me from a particular situation I'm attached to in this material world. And we know in the life of Srila Prabhupada that he could not understand why it was that Krishna was taking so many things away from him in his life. And then he read one famous verse in the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam, which says that when the Lord is especially favorable upon his devotee, then he takes away all of his material attachments. The affection of his family members and his wealth, all these things will be taken away. Why? So that the devotee can surrender to Krishna. So we saw in Srila Prabhupada's own life that when this took place, Prabhupada saw this as Krishna's favorable arrangement. Prabhupada actually said that one time he had an argument with Krishna. And in the argument, Prabhupada said, I will spread Krishna consciousness all around the world, but I want to do it as a rich man. Right? That's why Prabhupada, he wanted to become very rich. And then when he became very rich, then he would spread the movement all around the world. And Krishna said, no, I want you to do it as a poor man. And Krishna and Prabhupada were arguing. Prabhupada was saying, they were having an argument. Prabhupada saying, I want to do it as a rich man. And Krishna said, no, you'll do it as a small man. And Krishna won. Because he's a good. So then, Prabhupada had to spread Krishna consciousness as a poor person. He came with nothing to the West. And he fully relied upon Krishna. And by Krishna's mercy, when Krishna felt the time was right, Krishna sent all favorable circumstances and paraphernalia and facility so that Prabhupada could then spread Krishna consciousness all around the world. So the pure devotee sees that when Krishna takes something away, that is Krishna's desire for my own purification. And when he gives facility, this is also Krishna's desire so that we can increase the service of Krishna.
And do you remember
saying
the story of class? The other day, and he was saying how one devotee was coming in Great Britain regularly, and he was really sincere and like that. But then he disappeared for a year. And after he came back, the devotee was observing him, asked, "What happened to you? Where you have been?" He said, "This year was the worst in my life. I went bankrupt. I lost my job. My family left me. I lost all my friends, and I couldn't get together. And that happened only because." 1 year before, he was praying to Krishna, please remove all the obstacles from me.
He took everything away.
You gathered what we are praying.
Yeah, you have to be very careful when you pray. I know some devotees have prayed, like that's in the deities, please take away all my material desires. And then very soon after that, they caught a terminal illness. They prayed to Krishna, please take everything away. And then within a few months, they had diagnosed with cancer. And then within 6 months, they left this world. So if you pray like that before the deities, then they may deal with you as they desire to deal with. Bhakti Tirtha Swami also did the same thing. He prayed that let all the suffering of all the living entities in the world come upon me. Right? In that mood of Vasudev Datta, the great association of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And then, very soon after that, then they found a tumor on his foot, with it spread throughout his body, like that. So the devotee is actually desiring that all the material attachments be taken away, then Krishna can facilitate, like that. So it's in your heart. What you sincerely desire in your heart, if you sincerely desire, then Krishna will, according to how he desires. So.
Just now we are discussing, like, you have to see Krishna in every arrangement, if it's favorable or if it's not. And we get example of, like, Prabhupada or Vidura. Is it right to compare, like, neophyte devotees and see Krishna as the major arrangement because they are not on the same platform? But because the reason I say this is there is a very word of caution here. Something has to be done from individual point of view as well, rather than just leaving it, okay, it's Krishna's arrangement. So this takes the proactivity out of the human nature. I just want to know what's your opinion on this.
Yeah, so it means that the devotee, if he is sincere, you know, the devotee may not be very advanced, and he may have still struggling with his material desires, so he's not on the platform of Vidura or Srila Prabhupada or something like that, but he's very sincere. So if that is the case, then whatever happens in his life, he will see that as Krishna's arrangement. And devotees, we do like that. We see things as Krishna. We know that when something is happening in our life, if you're sincere, then you understand this is Krishna indicating something to me. So regardless of how advanced one is, Krishna is doing that from the very beginning of devotional service. So, yes.
Just elaborating on that point, I mean, if you fail to see that it's actually Krishna's doing that something happens to you, and you realize that only after you react to that external situation, how do you relate that to the independent action that you took without knowing that it's actually Krishna's doing? Because you've acted and you've taken a decision without fully knowing that it's, you know, Krishna's gift to you.
Yeah, so as a devotee advances more, as you become more advanced over time, then you will learn to see Krishna's arrangement from the very beginning of any situation which takes place in our life. because we still may be materialistic in consciousness in the beginning, then we may not be so conscious of Krishna when things are taking place. But the more you become advanced in Krishna consciousness, the more sincere in Krishna's sincerity, then you'll see Krishna is active like that. So Krishna is already doing that. It's just a matter of whether or not we abide by his will.
So if you realize after you take that decision that, oh, this is actually Krishna's doing, I might have had to react in a different way, how do you deal with that situation, knowing that maybe I didn't do the best possible thing for Krishna?
Yeah, so that's a learning experience. So we all make mistakes like that. But as you become more advanced and more sincere in Krishna consciousness, you learn to become more in tune with the super soul, with Krishna's direct guidance and so forth.
Any other points? One more question for you. When normally when Krishna gives us misery, it sometimes like because we are like relating to Lord with love, okay? Devotees relate to Lord with love. When Krishna gives us misery, sometimes we don't feel like talking to Krishna for 2-3 days, you know? That's our attitude. So what is that false ego or what is it?
Yeah, that's called false ego.
But actually, as soon as something bad happens to you, you're a devotee, and you're doing your devotional service properly, and then suddenly you get punished for that. And then similarly, 2-3 days, we don't like feel like, because Krishna didn't protect us, we don't feel like anything.
Yeah, so then you won't go back into the spiritual world as long as you're like that. As long as you have that kind of consciousness, you can't enter back into the spiritual world.
As soon as the science, even if your father is there for you and your father are there, suddenly your father slaps you, and then how can you talk very sweetly to your father immediately? For 1 or 2 days,
that means you don't love him fully or properly. Because the Bhakti, as said in the first canto of the Bhagavad Gita, it must be ahoy tuki apratihata. Right? So it must be without conditional. Right? And Krishna is the kind of, his nature is that he likes to play tricks on us.
Mm-hmm.
He likes it.
Mm-hmm.
He actually enjoys seeing us, you know, go through some tribulation or some on his behalf. Like that. So then you have to learn to see that this is Krishna doing this and be accept that from the very beginning.
Well, it's for my reformation, so I have to. It's for my purification. But later, after the misery goes, we know it's for our purification.
Yeah, but even during it, you have to learn to accept it favorably.
Mm-hmm.
That's adequate for meaning having a favorable attitude.
So even if you are punished, immediately you have to be released with Lord with love.
Yeah.
And say, this is what I deserve. So.
Yeah.
In this context, I remember one more point in Guruji Prabhu's session. He said that one of the reasons why Vidura is like this, because Vidura epitomizes the words which says Sitoshna Sukha Dukadara Tam Stitiksha Shubha. So saying that devotee, characteristic of a devotee is to be tolerant of anything that comes along the way. That was what Vidura demonstrated.
Yeah. Okay. The king asked Shrivinath Goswami, where and when did the meeting and discussion take place between Saint Vidura and His Grace Maitreya Muni? Kindly oblige my Lord and describe this to us. Saint Vidura was a great and pure devotee of the Lord, and therefore his question to His Grace, Rishi Maitreya, must have been very purposeful, on the highest level, and approved by a learned service. Jogika, your
question. Questions and answers among different classes of men have different values. Inquiries by mercantile men in a business exchange cannot be expected to be highly purposeful and spiritual values. Questions and answers by different classes of men can be guessed by the caliber of the persons concerned. In the Bhagavad Gita, the discussion was between Lord Krishna and Arjuna, the Supreme Person and the Supreme Devotee respectively. The Lord admitted Arjuna to be his devotee and friend, Bhagavad Gita 4.3, and therefore any sane man can guess that the discussion was on the topic of the Bhakti Yoga system. Actually, the whole Bhagavad Gita is based on the principle of Bhakti Yoga. There is a difference between karma and karma yoga. Karma is regulative action for the enjoyment of the fruit by the performer. But karma yoga is action performed by the devotee for the satisfaction of the Lord. Karma Yoga is based on bhakti or pleasing the Lord, whereas karma is based on pleasing the senses of the performer himself. According to Srimad Bhagavatam, one is advised to approach a bona fide spiritual master when one is actually inclined to question from an elevated level of spiritual understanding. A common man who has no interest in spiritual values has no need to approach a spiritual master just as a matter of following fashion. As a student, Maharaj Parikshit was serious about learning the science of God, and Sukadeva Goswami was a bona fide spiritual master in the transcendental science. Both of them knew that the topics discussed by Vidura and Rishi Maitreya were elevated, and thus Maharaj Parikshit was very interested in learning from the bona fide spiritual master.
Hmm. Very good. So what are the points here?
The caliber of the person discussion can be understood by what type of form they do. So if it's in the mercantile, so it's related to money, and if it's between devotee and Lord, so it's on bhakti yoga. And that's true even day to day life as well. We can get yes a person just by his questions and his answers.
Prabhupada says that in the second chapter of the Gita, okay, that a fool is recognized as soon as he opens his mouth. Any other points?
If you're an approaching spiritual master, you should have elevated spiritual topics to questions to ask.
Yeah. That's right. Someone else put there?
Those spiritual master and the disciples, they both have to be qualified.
This has
to be sincere
devotee,
spiritual
makers,
not in
sense and
manner.
Why should Prabhupada talking about karma and karma yoga here?
Because Prabhupada makes the point that he's describing the conversation which took place between Krishna and Arjuna, which is the Bhagavad Gita. And then Prabhupada makes the point that the Bhagavad Gita, because it's between the Lord and the Lord's bhakta, then the subject matter is bhakti yoga. And then the Bhakti Yoga section is chapters 7 to 12, whereas the earlier chapters are Karma Yoga and the later chapters are Jnana Yoga. So Prabhupada's making the point that even in the earlier chapters, if karma is connected to Krishna, as we learned in the earlier chapters of the Gita, then that is Karma Yoga. And Karma Yoga is Bhakti Yoga. Of course, then you have Nashkam, Karma Yoga, Sakam, Nashkam, and then pure Bhakti Yoga like that. So Prabhupada is describing the science which is taught within the Bhagavad Gita. Okay. Any other points?
In the same paragraph, it says karma is a regulated action by a performer. And again, two lines afterward it says it is only meant for the sense enjoyment of the performer. Once he uses the word regulated, it's authorized by dharma, so how it's meant for sense gratification?
Because Prabhupada says karma means worship of the devatas. The karma comes as section of the devatas. So the Vedas deal mainly with the three modes of material nature, and most of the Vedas, actually 96% of the Vedic literature, is the karma comes section of the Vedas, which teach to worship certain demigods to achieve certain material results. So that is karma, like that. Whereas when one makes the goal of one's karma, one's activity, for the pleasure of Krishna, that becomes karma yoga. And at that point then, because there's a transcendental objective, the Supreme Lord himself, then the activity elevates and purifies one on a transcendental path. Whereas karma just means material activity and you receive a material result. There's very little transcendental.
It says you have regulated karma, regulated action.
So it's regulated, yeah. Karma kind of means, if you want to go to the heavenly planets, or you want to attain wealth, if you read in the third chapter of the second canto in the beginning, then it describes if you want particular boons, then you worship these particular demigods. So this is karma.
Okay. So in those verses before karma yoga, Prabhupada also mentions that the yoga word comes from the word yuj, which means to link. So Prabhupada says that the whole objective of anything is to link ourselves with Krishna. As long as that is the purpose, then that becomes yoga, the same activity. Otherwise it doesn't.
Very good.
So karma yoga means we are linking the activity with Krishna, but still the purpose is like, if for example if we are doing some service over here, then that is not karma yoga, although that activity is for Krishna, no? So
well, technically, if you go technically, like in the Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentaries and so forth, then he says there's Sakam Karma Yoga, Nishkam Karma Yoga, right? And then you go up to Bhakti Yoga. Bhakti Yoga actually means on the transcendental platform, when you understand something about your identity in relationship with Krishna. So technically, Karma Yoga is Bhakti Yoga. It's within the same definition or category. Although, if you get technical, then you can break everything down. Sakam Karma, Nishkam Karma, Bhakti Yoga, all these things, of course.
So is it like in the, I think in the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, and the purpose it is said that if you are not able to do something, then at least do your work and give the money to Krishna. So is that karma yoga?
Yeah. You have to tie it around these asana, tie it around the back. If there's students on it. Yeah. I think. Yeah. In the 12th chapter then it mentions different levels. If you cannot do this, then you will do that. If you cannot do that, then do that. So you look, if you look at it technically, there'll be Nishkam Karma Yoga, Sakam Karma Yoga, Bhakti Yoga is also mentioned, and pure devotional service is also mentioned. So there's different levels, but it's all within the category of Bhakti Yoga. So if someone comes to the temple, they're doing devotional service to Krishna. All of us are doing devotional service, and we still have material desires. So does that mean it's not Bhakti? No, it is Bhakti. Right? But the Bhakti is mixed. Like Karma Mishra Bhakti, Jnana Mishra Bhakti, like that. So technically you would say it's Sakam Karma Yoga, technically. That's as Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, that's how he describes it and so forth. But it's Bhakti Yoga, it's all within the ladder of Bhakti Yoga. It's different levels on the different rungs on the ladder of Bhakti Yoga.
Because this activity, the service which we do in the temple will never come under karma, no? It's called akarma, no?
Karma means activity. That's why it's saying karma yoga. Karma means activity. You're washing the paraphernalia. That's karma. It's an activity.
It's not akarma.
Yeah, it is akarma. It is akarma because it's without reaction. Because it's devotional service. But this is also, that's the thing. To understand all this, you just have to understand the definitions are the same thing. It's just different words, but it's all the same thing. It's not like all the, sometimes the devotees get confused. Because they think, oh, this is karma yoga, this is sakam karma yoga, this is nishkam karma yoga, this is bhakti yoga, what am I doing? You know, what is it? You know, what am I doing? You know, am I a sakam karma yogi or, you know, what am I? People don't know what they are, right? But the point is, it's all bhakti yoga. It's all bhakti yoga. It's just different levels of devotion. That's all it is. So karma yoga is bhakti yoga. It's the same thing. Jnana yoga is bhakti yoga. Jnana yoga means to study transcendental subject matters. If you're studying the Srimad Bhagavatam, like what we're doing right now, this is jnana yoga. But it's bhakti yoga also. It's just a different word. It's the same thing. It's all bhakti yoga. But sometimes there's, you know, they get the acharyas may become technical. Say this is nishkam, this is sakam, this is jnana, this is raj, you know. All these things, but for us it all means bhakti yoga, it's just different. So devotees should not become too confused. Okay. So
I know what privilege is this, the regulated action.
Oh, Krishna.
It comes from Vedas.
Yeah, it does.
So that's the lowest step for the gradual elevation to the heaven. Is that right?
It means the activity must be done for the pleasure of Krishna. So if someone is doing the Karma Kanda section of the Vedas, they are worshipping the devatas, so that is karma. It is not karma yoga, it is karma, right? But the point is, because they are following the authority of the Vedas, then that will purify their consciousness like that. And the mantras chanted by the Brahmanas during the Yajnas, all the mantras end in worship of Vishnu. The mantras are actually worshipping Vishnu as the Jagyeshwara, as the supreme enjoyer of the sacrifice. So even though the sacrifice may be for Indra, for example, But actually, the mantras chanted will also be in glorification of Vishnu. And then it's also described that all of the demigods are actually parts of the Supreme Lord. So even the jagras for the demigods are actually worship of the Lord. And actually, the acharyas describe even the name, the title Vayu, the title Agni, the title Indra, all can be used to apply to the Supreme Lord as well. So indirectly, they're actually worshipping Krishna, but they don't realize it. Does that make sense? Or? Is that what you're asking? Okay, so the point which has been made here in the purport, Prabhupada saying in the very end of the purport, Maharaj Pariksit was serious about learning the science of God, and Shukadev Goswami was a bona fide spiritual master in the transcendental science. So when one is interested in understanding this very advanced level of spirituality, one must approach a bona fide spiritual master. So this was Vidura's desire. He wanted to understand all about the Lord, about the conversation that the Lord himself has spoken. So therefore, first he approached Uddhava, and Uddhava directed him to go and see Maitreya. And we'll describe that in the next few classes, why all those things took place like that. So the point is that when one is very sincere, very serious about understanding the transcendental science, he has to approach a bona fide spiritual master. Otherwise, it is not possible to understand the Supreme Lord. And this is the Lord himself, this is his system of approaching him. Tadvidi pranipatina, padiprashnena sevaya, upadekshanti te jnana. You must approach, that is Krishna's system for approaching him. And you must approach the bona fide guru if you are serious about understanding. This was also the final verse of the Chatur Shloki. One must inquire about this subject matter in all circumstances, sarvatra sarvada, in all places, all circumstances. One who has intense faith and desire to understand this. So this is what is taking place. Vidura is trying to find the person who can describe to him the glories of Krishna. And he approaches Uddhava, who is a fully qualified person, but then Uddhava directs him to Maitreya. And we'll see in the next few chapters why that takes place. Sri Suta Goswami said, the great sage Shukadev Goswami was highly experienced and was pleased with the king. Thus being questioned by the king, he said to him, please hear the topics attentively. Sri Shukadeva Goswami said, King Dhritarashtra became blind under the influence of impious desires to nourish his dishonest sons. And thus he set fire to the lacquer house to burn his fatherless nephews, the Pandavas. The king did not forbid his son, Dushasana's abominable action of grabbing the hair of Draupadi, the wife of the godly king Yudhishthira, even though her tears washed the red dust on her breast. Yudhishthira, who was born without any enemy, was unfairly defeated in gambling, but because he had taken the vow of truthfulness, he went off to the forest. When he came back in due course and begged the return of his rightful share of the kingdom, he was refused by Dhritarashtra, who was overwhelmed by the evil.
Maharaja Yudhishthira was the rightful heir to the father's kingdom. But just to favor his own sons, headed by Duryodhana, Dhritarashtra, Maharaja Yudhishthira's uncle, adopted various unfair means to cheat his nephews of their rightful share of the kingdom. At last, the Pandavas demanded only 5 villages, one for each of the 5 brothers, but that was also refused by the Sotsas. This incident led to the war of Kurukshetra. The battle of Kurukshetra, therefore, was induced by the Kurus and not the Pandavas. As Kshatriyas, the proper livelihood of the Pandavas was only to rule and not to accept any other occupation. A Brahmana, Kshatriya or Vaishya will not accept employment for his livelihood. under any circumstances.
So there's an interesting point which is made in this purport, which often comes up in our preaching. People say, if your religion is a true religion, then why is it that it's spoken on a battlefield? And why is it that your God, Krishna, is a God of war? Right? People say this, especially in today's world climate. You know, it's a very topical situation because we see there's Muslim extremists, right? Within a particular Islamic faith, there are some very extreme people within that faith, not the general Islam people, not the general Muslim people, but some very extreme radicals who are doing war in the name of religion, right? Which is completely concocted, nothing to do with God whatsoever, right? Just the man's three modes of material nature, basically. A mixture of passion and ignorance.
Fanatics.
Yeah, fanatics. Yeah, just lower modes of nature working. And these people are creating wars and so forth. So people sometimes criticize, why is your God speaking about war? But you must understand, and we explain this to people, that the Bhagavad Gita is one chapter of a much larger work. Right? And there's only 700 verses. It's part of the Mahabharata, which is 118,000 verses. Now, if you understand the entire history of this particular battle, Krishna and Yudhishthira and the Pandavas did everything in their power to prevent that war. It was not the first option. It was their last option. Right? So you have to explain this to people. Right? It's not that Krishna was a god of war. Right? This was the final option. Right? Krishna had to go back to Yudhishthira after trying everything in their power. Krishna himself went as the messenger of the Pandavas to Hastinapur, right? All the way from Indraprastha to Hastinapur, right? To visit Duryodhana, and he said, please give back half the kingdom. He said, the kingdom belongs to Yudhishthira, it's not even your kingdom. The Yudhishthira is willing to divide it in half, out of goodwill. Right? And Duryodhana said, arrest him. Right? And they all the soldiers came forth to arrest Krishna. Right? And then Krishna suddenly he showed some very spectacular a very spectacular spectacle of that, and then everyone was taken aback. So you must understand this point, right, when we're preaching to people, that Krishna is not a god of war, Krishna is a god of peace. Right? And war was the last option. He went back to Yudhishthira and he said, there's no other choice now. We have to go to war. So Yudhishthira said, okay, we'll go to war. That was the final option.
Because Prabhupada says that the battle was induced by the Kuruvas and not
the Pandavas. Yeah, it was the Kuruvas who did it. The Pandavas tried to avoid it, but Duryodhana was bent on war, so that was the
one.
Well,
what it mentions in the verse that Yudhishthira didn't have any men. According to our estimation, you know, he couldn't have the worst enemy to try to poison him, to kill him, and so many things, to burn him. He was born without any
many
times.
He was born, yes. Ajatashatru. That's his name. Because it says that even Duryodhana, who hated all the Pandavas, he could not find any fault in Yudhishthira. Even Duryodhana.
He did so many things.
He did, but he did because he was one of the five Pandavas. But mainly he was inimical to Bhima and the others, mainly. Even though, yeah, he was trying to kill him, but in his heart, he could not find any fault. And at the Rajasuya sacrifice, which Yudhishthira performed, which is in the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam, at the Rajasuya sacrifice, even Duryodhana voluntarily came to the sacrifice and assisted Yudhishthira in the sacrifice. Because that's how perfect Yudhishthira was, that he would even assist Yudhishthira, even though he was supposed to be his rival.
Would
having
known
men's
name also that Yudhishthira within himself had no enemies?
No, it means that no one disliked Yudhishthira. There wasn't anyone who disliked him. Even Duryodhana didn't dislike him. Even though he was trying to kill him. Mm-hmm. But everyone liked him. He was so perfect.
You saw a small clarification that Mother Gandhari did say to Lord Krishna, saying that, look, if you really wanted to stop the war, you could have done it, but you were not really interested in stopping the war. So just as you are responsible for killing my entire family, equally, I curse that your entire dynasty is destroyed. So that's the point she makes in Mahabharata.
Yeah, because Krishna did not want the war, because every jiva has independence. So Krishna advised them, don't fight. That would have been Krishna's preference, but because they had a demoniac nature, and one of Krishna's missions is to destroy the demoniac, then if that's how the demoniac will act, then Krishna will destroy them. But he advised them not to fight.
A bit of a side issue, but that instance where Duryodhana tried to capture Krishna,
yeah,
he left the assembly for some time and everyone knew what was about to happen. Like Vidura knew that they were going to get the army and come back and attack Krishna. We hear how devotees don't tolerate violence. They tolerate violence on themselves, but they don't tolerate violence on others. So there's so many instances like that where the Pandavas are being attacked or Krishna is being attacked, but nobody actually intervenes with physical ability.
Yeah, because their loyalty is bound to the Kuru dynasty.
Even Vidura.
Well, Vidura mentions, I mean, one answer I can give is it mentions in this section that Vidura was not actually a Kshatriya. He was not considered a member of the Kshatriya order.
Well, he carries a bow.
Carries a bow, true, but even the Vaishyas carry bows. But it's mentioned that Nanda Maharaj would carry a bow to protect the Vaishyas like that. But he was not considered to be a member of the Kshatriya order. So,
when as you read the Mahabharata, you almost get frustrated hearing how many times they try to convince Dhritarashtra. Whereas it seems that somebody should step in and...
That's where the complication was, that they were members of the Kuru dynasty and they're trying their best within the family. You imagine like you're the royal family and you've got a member of the family who's right, you know, off the rail. But it's the royal family, so you've really got to try to keep, you know, trying to talk sense in this person. So they're just trying to do the right thing, you know, in terms of social and moral etiquette. What could be done? Then that's, you know, they did everything the right way, the nice way, and then it just, in the end, it came to a war. That was the only thing to do.
Excuse me. I was talking to a friend yesterday who argued that the Pandavas, being pure, shouldn't have gambled the kingdom in the first place.
No, it's Kshatriyas, it's part of their like codes and laws that if they're challenged to a fight or a gambling match, they're not allowed to, by Kshatriya nature, they're not allowed to step away. If someone challenges them to a fight, they must fight, otherwise they're dishonored. And same, it says with gambling also, it's like a Kshatriya, it's just a sport, they gamble. If someone says, you know, gamble, then they have to enter into it. So it's like a Kshatriya
code of conduct.
Tradition, code of conduct like that. And it's all about their honor. Like that. If they don't do it, then they're considered dishonored. So it's all about honor. Honor is everything for the Kshatriya. Krishna says in the second chapter of the Gita, dishonor is worse than death. He says to Arjuna, dishonor is worse.
Just going on from that, why did he put up his wife as a stake stone?
Because that was the.
Where's the honor in that? Because that's.
That's what I. Yeah, that was very questionable.
But they asked for a.
That was very questionable. Mm-hmm. It comes to the whole honor thing. For the Kshatriyas, it's like...
There's no honour in putting up your mistress' estate.
But if you took in terms of a Vedic setting and Kshatriyas, it would be considered dishonourable not to do it. Right? But then it was very questionable because Arjuna later criticised Yudhishthira for it at one point in time during the battle itself. The question. So you're right, it is... considered like that, but it's still all to do with that honour thing. And for a Kshatriya, dishonour is worse than death. So even if the stakes get up to that kind of thing. The point is that normally between sane Kshatriyas, that kind of thing wouldn't happen. But then when it came to people like Duryodhana and that kind of thing, then they started saying, okay, your wife and all these kind of things. And then he was bent because of his, he took vows of truthfulness and so forth. So he would not break away from morality, which is actually his defect, which is pointed out by Krishna during the battle itself. That Krishna said, please lie during the battle. He said, please lie, and he would not lie, so therefore. So that was one of Yudhishthira's faults, that he was so attached to morality and things. I agree with you, but they're kind of both sides of the story. So, I'm going to keep reading because we just need to cover the subject a little bit. So. Lord Krishna was sent by Arjuna into the assembly as the spiritual master of the world. And although his words were heard by some like Bhishma and pure nectar, it was not so for the others, who were completely bereft of the last farthing of pious works. The king Dhritarashtra or Duryodhana did not take the words of Lord Krishna very seriously. So we see here the mood of the Bhagavatam once again manifesting in Krishna's pastimes, that he took the role of a messenger for the Pandavas. And you saw that within the pastimes of the Bhagavatam, the Mahabharata, Krishna took the role of a chariot driver for Arjuna. A chariot driver is considered to be the work of a Shudra. So for Krishna to take that role shows how much devotion Krishna has for his devotees as Bhakta Vatsala, as the lover of his devotees. Because he even takes very menial positions. Like a messenger is not considered to be an exalted position. You have messengers. The king has messengers. Krishna is a prince of the Yadu dynasty, and Arjuna sends a prince to be his messenger. Normally that would not take place. Those kind of things would not. So this shows Krishna's total opulence of renunciation. Right? No attachment to prestige or anything. Right? When Krishna says, I declare it boldly, my devotee will never perish, in the Bhagavad Gita, and all the statements he makes about his devotees within the Bhagavad Gita, which is the essence of the Gita, Krishna's love for his devotees, and vice versa, Krishna is displaying this practically in all of his pastimes. So this is actually the essence of the Bhagavatam. These kind of verses are actually what the Bhagavatam is about, and that is what our heart is meant to do. That's why the Bhagavatam says, your heart is still praying, yet tears do not come when you hear these kind of things. Right? One who has devotion to Krishna should feel so much emotion when he hears about Krishna's love for his devotees, tears should swell in the eyes. This should be the bath, the emotion. Now this personality who was mentioned here,
I think it was mentioned here.
Maybe it's in the next verse. Who is Shakuni mentioned? Shakuni? I thought it was mentioned just there.
It's in 14.
Okay, we'll get to Shikoni when we get to this. I thought it was in that text or something. Yeah, okay. When Vidura was invited by his elder brother Dhritarashtra for consultation, he entered the house and gave instructions which were exactly to the point. His advice is well known, and instructions by Vidura are approved by expert ministers of state. Now listen to Vidura's instructions. What we learn in the next few verses is something about the